Good morning, everybody. Here I am again, and I just want to know that we were praying for you this morning, thinking of you this morning, and just desiring to be with you. And going back to that red letter challenge, part of the reason is just for unity, something for us to be doing together as we walk out our relationship with Jesus. Thinking about that this week, I was thinking about years ago when I was a teenager. And how God just really got a hold of my heart during those years. And as a teenager, really developed a passion for Jesus, really developed a passion for serving God. And during those years of developing that relationship with God at an early age through my teen years, there was a real desire to just know and understand the will of God for my life. Maybe you can understand that. Oftentimes for me at those moments, it was thinking about the big decisions that I had to make looking forward in my life. Maybe it was things like, you know, what education I was going to have. What was I going to do after I graduated from high school? You know, what post-secondary education was going to looking for the will of God for my life in that area. Even things like, you know, what girl am I going to date? Or maybe even like looking even further than that in terms of who I'm going to marry. What job that I was going to have? What city I was going to live in? You know, all those big decisions that you have in life. And just really prayed, probably on a regular basis, God, would you show me your will? As I've gotten older, those prayers have changed. And in many ways, I think the prayers have changed because as I've gotten to know who God is and how he operates a little bit better, I came to realize that most, probably 85 or even 95% of what God's will is for our lives is actually shown to me through the life and work of Jesus Christ. It's not something that I need to pray about for God to show me on a daily basis, but Jesus has already shown me through his words and through his actions. So today, we're going to be continuing our series, Kingdom Resolutions, and it really is walking through the Beatitudes of Jesus in Matthew chapter 5. Today, we're going to be hitting three different verses, and they're small and they're compact. But in a lot of ways, if we can grab a hold of those three verses, I believe that it really shows us the will of God for our lives today, tomorrow, and for the rest of your life. So why don't you join with me? I'm going to be reading from Matthew chapter 5. It starts in verse 6. And it says this, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled." Simple sentence. The blessing of God, the favor of God is going to come upon somebody who is in this situation. If you're a person who is hungering and thirsting after righteousness, it's not just the blessing and favor, but Jesus promises those hearers that they're going to be filled, that their desire will be filled. What do you hunger and what do you thirst after? I think for us in the 21st century, especially for those of us who live in Canada, we connect that more to cravings. What do you crave? Do you crave some Cheetos? Do you crave some Doritos? I mean, I don't know about you, but I don't know if this represents what you crave, but I mean, things like this, I crave. Cheetos, not so much. Maybe that's for you. Is Coca-Cola something that you crave? I know for a lot of people who've gone on diets over the years, it's like they've sworn off of sugary pop. Does this make you crave it? Let's get rid of that. What do you crave after? When we think about hungering and thirsting after things, I think, you know, to be honest, I think we struggle within the 21st century to truly know what that means. We crave for stuff. It's stuff that maybe we want, but we don't need. I think majority of the time we really don't need those things. But I think of when Jesus was saying those things and he's sitting in front of a crowd of people in the first century, I think when he talked about hungering and thirsting, they really understood and knew what that meant. Historians look at the first century in the Roman Empire, and the average person, they say easily between 80 to 90% of the people who lived within the Roman Empire at that time really lived hand-to-mouth every single day. They didn't know what they were going to eat tomorrow, never mind today. And they struggled with it on a daily basis. Think about that, 80 to 90% of the population. And so they didn't have pantries full of food. They weren't able to go to Costco and stock up on their favorite item, put it in the freezer, put it in the fridge. I mean, none of that, those things existed. It was really, really bare bones. And so when Jesus is talking to them about hunger, they're like, oh yeah, I fully get that. I know that. That is something that they experienced on a daily basis. Never mind craving something. That idea of craving something, I don't even know if that existed for them. It was a matter of survival. I don't know about you, but within my house, I'm able to take a glass and I go to my fridge and there's like a water dispenser right in my fridge, right? I can hit the ice thing and I put my glass underneath there and ice falls into my cup and then I hit water and the water pours into my cup. And no, whenever I want something to drink, it is right there, ice cold water. Not just ice cold water, but it's like, it's even filtered of all things. And it's right there for me. Think of the first century when Jesus is talking about hungering and thirsting for the people who thirst. There's no fridge in their house to give them cold water. They have to walk to the well. Maybe that's even a kilometer away from where they live. They got to get up early, and they got to do that on a big daily basis. They bring their buckets, their jars, whatever they're carrying with them. And they got to get down into the well, and they got to lower that bucket, and they got to pull it up, and they got to fill their buckets full of water for the day. And then they're tracking that back to their house, and it's got to last them for the day. It's not cold water. It's not filled with ice. It's just regular water from the well. I think when they thought of thirst, they knew exactly what Jesus was talking about. It's not just desiring something. It's needing something. It's a matter of life and death. And so they hunger and thirst after. In fact, I think when Jesus talks about hungering and thirsting after righteousness, I think maybe this verse popped into their head. Psalm 42, verse 1. It says, as the deer pants for streams of water, so my soul pants for you, my God. As the deer pants for water. I don't know. I don't really watch deer panting for water very often, but I'll tell you this. I have a dog, and I'll take him out for a walk. And every so often, you know, I got this little white dog, little Scooter, and I take him out for a walk, and I'll get him to run. And man, that little dog can really give her when he runs. And he'll run, and we'll go out for a walk, and there's no water in sight. And then I take him home, and he's, by the time we get home, that dog is panting. It's panting. He's trying to cool himself down. And the moment I open up that door, where does that dog go to first? He goes right to his water bowl because he's thirsting after water. As the deer pants for streams of water, so my soul longs for you, my God. So hungering and thirsting. Hungering and thirsting for what? Jesus talks about righteousness. What does that mean? When you think of righteousness, what does that mean? I think for oftentimes what pops in my head, and I think for us on a daily basis, this idea of like right and wrong, doing what's right and wrong, desiring what's right and wrong. But my mind goes again back to the first century. What did a first century Jew equal with righteousness? And I think for the average person living 2,000 years ago in a Jewish context, it was the idea of conformity to the Torah or conformity to the law that is expressed in the Old Testament. It was this idea of covenant faithfulness, that God had made a covenant with the people of Israel through Moses. And they needed to keep that covenant. They needed to obey the laws. They needed to conform to those expectations. And for them, I think when Jesus is talking about righteousness, they probably were thinking about that. But I think if we dive deeper, we have to ask ourselves the question, what did Jesus think of? What did he mean by hungering and thirsting after righteousness? In the Old Testament law, I mean, for the average Jew, they're thinking when Jesus is talking about hungering and thirsting after righteousness, their mind might go to Psalm 119. It says, blessed are those whose ways are blameless, who walk according to the law of the Lord. Sounds familiar, right? Connects to this, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. It's this law connection. So why don't we hop a little bit forward? If we're wondering what Jesus meant by this, maybe let's look at Matthew 22. Someone comes to Jesus and he has a question. And this idea probably of righteousness is in his mind. And he asks Jesus, teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law? Jesus replied, love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. So when you think about conformity to the law, if you go into the Old Testament, oh my goodness, there's hundreds of laws. How do I make it all straight? Never mind like memorize it all. How do I do this? And Jesus distills every single law in the Old Testament. He brings it down to these two and he says, man, they all hang on these two. They're all connected to these two. Love your God. Love him with everything that you have, with your heart, with your soul, with your mind. Love him completely. And then he brings up this idea of how we treat others, loving others in the same way that we love ourselves. It's about love. This hunger and thirsting isn't about just about survival. It's about love. It's about loving God. When you love someone, what is it that you do? When you fall, let's go even like further and say, like when you fall in love, everything changes. When you fall in love with someone, it's no longer about just what you want anymore. But all of a sudden it's like you want what that person wants. You start trying to figure out what is it that they like to do? What are their desires? And you try to fulfill their desires because you love them. When their birthday comes along, you're not buying them something that you want. You're trying to figure out what this person desires. And you go out of your way to try and purchase that for them because you love them. Does that connect with our relationship with God? Is that if we love God with everything that we have, it's no longer about what we want. But now we start seeking after, we try to know the heart of God, and we start asking those questions, Jesus, what is it that you want? God, what are your desires? How can I fulfill the things that you desire? Because all of a sudden the focus stops being upon me, and it starts being upon him. And our life starts to revolve around that. We check our passions at the door. It's not that we don't have passions anymore. It's not that we don't have desires anymore, but it's our love for that person is so great that those become secondary. And the things that God desires, the things that are so important to God, they start welling up in our heart and we start desiring it. It's a natural desire for us because of our love for him. Yes, we have passions and we have desires, but our desire for communion with God is greater. Not just that, but the welfare of others is greater. We understand that God's heart is for people, that he loves people. And that's why Jesus said all the law and the prophets, they kind of hang on those two things. It's not just about loving God, but it's about loving people. I don't know about you, but I've ran into religious people before, and they seem like they're so passionate about Jesus, and yet it seems like they hate people. You ever met like someone like that before? They're passionate about maybe the Bible. They're passionate about fulfilling what they feel is God's wants, but in reality, that doesn't translate to how they interact with people. And I think that's why this is so important, that when it's hungering and thirsting after righteousness, it's not just hungering after God, but it's really trying to figure out, how is it that I can love people? And they have to go hand in hand. They can't be separated. This isn't about us trying to seek after righteousness for ourselves. This isn't about us becoming righteous. Because I think at the end of the day, when we follow the life of Jesus, we recognize that our righteousness ends up being given to us by Jesus. So this isn't about seeking after our righteousness and becoming righteous. But it truly is just seeking after Jesus and understanding how he operates and loving on him. Loving on him in all the ways that I just said. It's about desiring the one that makes us righteous. I like the way Eugene Peterson says it in The Message. He says, "You're blessed when you've worked up a good appetite for God. He's food and drink and the best meal you'll ever eat." I like that. He's food and drink and the best meal you'll ever eat. There's a blessing that comes in having an appetite for God, because he says, I can fill that. So if you're wondering what the will of God is for your life, this is the first part. Let's move on to the second part. Verse 7 of chapter 5, Jesus says, "Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy." There's a blessing that's going to come upon you when you're merciful. And part of that blessing is the fact that you are going to experience mercy as well. When we think about mercy, I think it's so much more than our value in our culture today of niceness and tolerance. You know how people, like, when they try to explain what Canadians are like, you know, they're like, "Oh, Canadians are nice." And maybe even there's this value of tolerance, and yet this idea of mercy is so much more than that. It goes so far greater than that. Mercy is actually concrete actions of love. It's not just tolerance, but it's concrete actions of love and compassion. It's this idea of sympathetic grace towards others. That sympathetic grace to those people who are oppressed, those that have experienced tragedy, and it's sympathetic grace to those who have sinned. It's this idea of, Jesus talks about, in terms of the golden rule, about doing to others that you would have them do to you. Those who are merciful, they've experienced the mercy of God themselves. And because they've experienced the mercy of God themselves, it flows out of their life to other people. And it ends up becoming this circular effect, where as you pour it out, you receive more. And as you receive more, you pour it out. And that's where the blessing comes from. The merciful enter into the injustices of others. They enter into the tragedy of others, and they experience it for themselves. I think when we look at the biblical definition of mercy, it's actually getting inside someone else's skin and experience life like they've experienced. That's what Jesus did. He got inside human skin and experienced what we experienced. That is mercy. It's getting behind someone else's eyes, seeing life through their eyes. It's so much more than pity. Sometimes we connect pity to mercy. Pity is this idea of separation, where you're able to look from a distance and feel sorry for somebody. But mercy really is this aspect of diving into the experience that someone else has had. I think of the story of the Good Samaritan in the Bible that Jesus talks about. Luke describes this in his book, and it's this story that Jesus told of someone traveling from one city to the next. And as they're traveling, they end up being jumped by bandits, and they're beat up, left for dead on the side of the road. Everything that they've had has been stolen. And they're dying on the side of the road. And there's people who come by and they see that person sitting on the side of the road and they have pity towards him. They look at him and they go, oh, that's too bad. But they continue on. But the Good Samaritan was that one who just didn't take pity on him, but he had mercy. He entered into his experience. He took responsibility for that person on the side of the road, put him on his donkey, brought him to an inn, paid for him to get well. He entered into his tragedy with him. And you know, sometimes when you have mercy, people are going to look at you and say that you're being taken advantage of. Have you ever felt that way, or have you ever experienced that? When you have mercy upon somebody, or you see someone else who's had mercy on somebody, and there's that feeling of, oh man, they're being taken advantage of. Sometimes that is the case, and that's the way the world looks at it. There's this New York Times best-selling author. His name is Bob Goff, and he's written a really, really popular book called Love Does. And it's just a book describing about loving on people because of the love of Jesus. And at the end of his book, he actually puts his cell phone number at the back of his book. Seems crazy, hey? Write a book that's a New York Times bestseller, put your cell phone number at the back of the book so anybody, any Tom, Dick, and Harry can give you a call. But Bob's desire is that he puts his number at the back because he wants to be available for people. And when you're available to people, you end up being taken advantage of. And in his next book, Everyone Always, he describes in one of the chapters about some of the people who started giving him a call. And there's someone in a state penitentiary in prison that must have got a hold of his phone number through that book and started giving him calls. And every single time he'd receive a call from this guy in prison, it was a collect call. And it would be like, you know, there's a collect call for you. If you accept this, you're going to be charged $10. And every single time, Bob just says, yep. He had no idea the first time who was calling him, but he said, yep, I'm going to accept it. And he picks up the phone. And there's this guy on the other end that's stuck in prison, and he's just looking for someone that's going to help him connect with his mother, looking for someone that's going to help him connect with his ex-wife. And he continues to call Bob, and every single time he accepts it, he accepts the next $10. And from the outside looking in, the whole situation is, Bob, you're being taken advantage of. But Bob's heart is, I'm going to be available. I'm going to be available. Because he looks through life through eyes of mercies, entering into the skin and the eyes of the person that he's having mercy upon. James chapter 2, in verse 12, this is what he says. He says, speak and act as those who are going to be judged by the law that gives freedom. That's interesting. Being judged by the law that brings freedom. Usually when you think about judgment, you're not thinking about freedom. Verse 13, he says, because judgment without mercy will be shown to anyone who has not been merciful. Mercy triumphs over judgment. When you think about Christianity, when you think about religion, do you think about mercy or do you think about judgment? When you think about God, when you think about Jesus, do you think about mercy or do you think about judgment? And I think depending on what you think of tells a lot about maybe where you are at or maybe what you've been taught, what you've heard. Jesus makes it very clear, and James, the half-brother of Jesus, makes it very clear that mercy triumphs over judgment. And it's easy to judge, isn't it? We see people who live in ways that we don't live. And when they live ways that we don't live, we judge them. Especially when they get themselves into trouble and they're in situations that they shouldn't be. And we're able to look at them and be like, man, if they just did what I do, if they just live how I believe they should live, they would be okay. And we judge. Or maybe it has to do with like people who believe different things that you believe. And we see this all over the internet today, right? People who post stuff on Facebook, people who post stuff on YouTube, people who post stuff in the news, whatever. And maybe their way of looking at the world is different than yours. And we're able to judge them. Man, if they just saw things the way I see them, if they could just see the truth, everything would be different. We have to take a step back. Do we have mercy? Mercy triumphs over judgment. And you know, it doesn't mean that we don't have opinions. It doesn't mean that we don't have our own convictions. But it's being able to separate our own opinions, being able to separate our own convictions, being able to put ourselves in their seat, in their shoes. Maybe asking some questions. Why is it that they think the way they think? Why is it they live the way they live? Putting yourself and being able to see life through their eyes and having mercy on them. Once again, Eugene Peterson, this is how he says it. He says, "You're blessed when you care. At the moment of being careful," I like the way he says that, full of care, "you find yourself cared for." Isn't that what we want? We just want to be cared for. And God says there's a blessing upon you when you are like this, because it's going to actually come full circle back to you. So let's move on to the last one. You want to know the will of God for your life. We talked about these two things. This last one, in verse 8, Jesus says this, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God." Blessed are the pure in heart. It doesn't say blessed are those who are pure, right? It says blessed are those who are pure in heart. There's a temptation towards outward purity, and we see this in the story of Jesus, right? As the people that he really comes hard against are the religious leaders, who are more interested in what people see, the outward appearance of purity, than the purity of the heart. And that's a temptation, isn't it? That is a temptation for me as a pastor. Am I more concerned with what people see than who I am on the inside? Am I more concerned with what people see than what God sees? Am I truly pure in heart, or is this just an outward thing to gain social honor? To gain social honor. In a lot of ways, it's connected to our motives, isn't it? What are we motivated? Why do we do the things that we do? So that people can see what we do? Or for God? It's interesting, when you get past Matthew chapter 5 and the Beatitudes, you hit Matthew chapter 6, and it's a commentary on this aspect of pure in heart. I encourage you to read it at home. Jesus talks about giving. He talks about prayer. He talks about fasting, and it's all through the eyes of being pure in heart, the motives of the heart. Why are you giving? Why are you praying? Why are you fasting? Is it so that other people can see you doing it and to gain the honor from them? Or is it out of purity of heart and motive that you are doing it? I think when Jesus talked about the pure in heart, I think maybe their mind could have gone to Psalm 24. And it says this, "Who may ascend the mountain of the Lord? Who may stand in his holy place? The one who has clean hands and a pure heart, who does not trust in an idol or swear by a false god." The trust isn't in ourselves. It's not in the idols of what other people think. It's about just caring about what God thinks. And it says those who see God, this isn't necessarily about seeing God in the future. It's not about like when we get to heaven, we will see God. No, I think that Jesus is talking about the here and now. He's talking about us being able to see God in your everyday experience. When you wake up and you go to bed, when you interact with people, when you do your work in the everyday mundane, are you able to see God? Because if you have a pure heart, you see God all around you. when our heart is not pure, everything is blinded, everything becomes blurry, and we can't see God. When our heart is filled with skepticism, man, we can't see God. When our heart is hard towards others, we can't see God. He's blinded to us. When our heart is filled with selfish motives, we can't see God. We just see ourselves. But Jesus promises us that when we have a pure heart, man, we're going to experience Him. We're going to see Him. And I know about you, but I desire that. I want that so much. God, may I see you. May I see you today. So Eugene Peterson, The Message, this is the way he says it. He says, you're blessed when you get your inside world, your mind and your heart put right. Then you can see God in the outside world. It's about your inside world. And when we go back to that subject of the will of God, these three things, it sums up all of it. This is the only three verses that you had and you were wondering, God, what is your will for my life? It's all in this. Jesus, may I hunger and thirst for you. May I hunger and thirst for you. May I know what you desire. May I give you what you desire. May that be lived out with how I love other people. Jesus, would I be a person of mercy, not of judgment? It's so easy to judge and it just flows out so easy. But Lord, I pray that as I experience your mercy, that would flow out of my life to other people. And Jesus, as I have a heart for you and people, and as I be a person of mercy, I pray, God, that I would come out of a pure heart. Not an outward show of religiosity, but may my motives be pure because I want to see you. We're just going to close right now. I've asked the band to come and to join us. We're just going to take a few minutes just to focus on Jesus, and then we'll be finished our service. May this be who we are. May we pursue this with all that we have. Because no matter where you're at, no matter how closed up you are, separated from people, you can never be separated from the love of God. Jesus, we love you. Jesus, we love you. And may this represent who we are in you. In Jesus' name, amen.